It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
Okay.
Which sounds like a song from Miss Saigon.
It doesn't. That actually doesn't happen on regular phones either, that when the person hangs up, it goes right to a dial tone.
No, it can eventually. Or it used to. It would click, click, and then you wait.
It'd be a little, it'd be a little while.
Anyway, hello. Oh, shit, I didn't think one up. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat Podcast, the only podcast where you might actually hear a live electrocution on the episode.
How's that going to happen?
It's thunder and stuff, so the house gets hit with lightning.
I guess.
And then somehow we will magically post it to the internet anyway.
Well, maybe only one of us gets electrocuted.
But the computer would be pretty
fucked. Yeah, I suppose.
So, if you're hearing this, we're probably not dead. As of this recording. For us, it has been a few minutes. We watched some kid snippets. Now we're here. For those of you just joining us this episode, that's weird.
Are we going to say who we are?
Oh, I'm Tony.
And I'm William, and this is episode 160.
Yes. Sorry, it was just a few minutes ago for me. We have a hat, it's magic, it has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Listeners, like yourself, write into that email address with comments, questions, topics, things like that. For us, the hat, all on its own, magically transmogrifies those emails into little note cards with the information written on them that manifest physically within the cavity of the hat itself, and we reach in there and draw them out at random, read them on the podcast, discuss them till we are bored, repeat until we've wasted an hour. That's the show.
Yeah, we just pull stuff out of the cavity.
Yes, of the hat. We make holes in teeth. So, William, how was your week?
I think we established this last time. You are the one who's saved up some stuff to talk about. So
I didn't save it up. It was just there.
About, I suppose I could say something about the whole House of Cards thing, since we have a little time.
Yeah. You remember what you were going to say now?
I kind of. One thing is, when we were first talking about House of Cards, and you were talking about, I'd only watched the first episode, and I was talking about how authentic it seemed.
Yes.
As I watched it all the way through, and two seasons all the way through, I didn't feel like it was very authentic, or even trying to be. I don't feel like House of Cards is something you watch if you want to see authentic American political drama.
No, it doesn't have that vibe.
I don't think that's what it's going for at all.
It's sort of a darker Aaron Sorkin kind of thing.
Well, I really get the feeling that it's like it's telling a story that's almost medieval and feudal, but putting it in this kind putting it in this kind of environment. And so,
well, as noted by the fact that it's a remake of something in a different country from 20 years ago.
Sure. So, it's not a mistake that it doesn't have that feeling of authenticity. I think it's a stylistic choice. You're not supposed to, well, I mean, for one thing, you see people in Congress, sitting around enjoying a private lunch once in a while, which probably never happened.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. But again,
speaking of which, the congressional cafeteria looks like shit.
But again, I think that's probably a deliberate choice. But also sometimes, like there's one point where he's in these really important negotiations and meetings, and he's called away to his home district, and the reason he's called away seems really implausible. And
you think?
Yeah, very implausible. Very implausible. And even silly. Now, again, I don't think that's a mistake. I think I think that's all part of the style.
Oh,
of
I think
it.
Everything they do is deliberate.
No, yeah, I totally agree. But if you understand that this show is really not about authentic political intrigue or really getting to know the inner workings of the government or pulling aside the veil to see what people do. It's not that. It's really very much about these characters, their interactions, and yes. There is the Machiavellian aspect of it. There is that.
Yeah.
And you do get this interesting impression, like you were talking about before, that a lot of government probably does work like that.
Yeah.
But that's not really the point.
No.
The point is about...
It's a look at humanity and a look at power.
Yeah,
and
it's a story that you could tell in a more, like in the Tudors or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But we're telling it in this environment because, well, it's just a stylistic choice, and I think it's a good one. And as far as it goes, I think that's very interesting.
Well, and
I like it. But a lot of the stuff I said about it before, just based on the first viewing, yeah. I don't think anymore.
Well, and one could actually make the argument that part of the message here is that politics, at its heart, doesn't change.
No, in fact, I think...
civilization yes, has existed enough to have politics.
I think that's exactly what it's saying. Yeah. I think that's kind of part of the point is, look, we're going to tell this story. We're putting it in this venue, in this place... But really, the story itself, we're gonna focus mostly on those aspects of it that are kind of timeless, okay, that you can put anywhere in time and space, and in fact, I kind of like that about it. I think that's an interesting thing, and the characters are very good, and the acting is very good, and the writing, again, if you're not expecting it to be authentic political drama it's authentic political drama. It's not authentic
modern,
American political drama. If you're not expecting it to be that, it's actually really fascinating what they're doing and how they're doing it.
I have a question for you. So you've watched the whole thing.
Yeah.
All right. We are still about midway through season two. Mm. I have a question, and it's technically a spoiler, and I hate those, but it's a yes or no thing, and I want to know. This came from the first season. But you've seen the second season, so I'm just going to tell. Because this might be the one situation where I'm like, I don't get what the fuck the point was. Does the goddamn origami thing ever pay off?
Pay off?
Do we ever figure out what the hell the point was?
Because
we didn't in season one.
No.
Alright, I was afraid of that. That was some esoteric shit in the beginning, and then it went nowhere. Yeah.
Well, except...
I'm sure they think they were symbolically showing something. I didn't really feel it. But we shouldn't get into too much detail, because then it really does get spoiled.
I know, but the thing about that character, Claire Underwood, who is the wife of arguably the main character...
Yes.
It's really hard to understand sometimes what they're doing with her.
Because they can't make up their mind between doing some really clever original shit and some really old cliched.
Well, and you don't know
sexist bullshit.
You don't know if that's.
And sometimes they fake you out.
Yeah.
Yes.
You, sometimes you think, now this isn't really very consistent. This is
so
weird.
Trite, and then it's like, oh wait.
Yeah, yeah, and then and like you said, it seems like they can't make up their mind, but then something happens later. It's like, oh no.
Yeah.
They're just trying to. This character is just that complex, so it is hard to tell. Is this a really complex character, or are they just writing her really badly? And Robin Wright really deserves a lot of credit for tying all this together and making...
And playing what I think is an almost impossible character to play effectively.
Yeah.
That's a harder role to do than Kevin Spacey's role. He's doing a great job with it, but I feel like her role would just be really hard to do. It's so subtle, it's so nuanced, it's so complex.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's doing an amazing job.
Well, and there are a lot of surprises in it. There are a lot of things that happen that you didn't really see coming. And
it's not bullshit M. Night Shyamalan twists.
No.
It's just sort of situations where suddenly your perspective steps out in order of magnitude and you see the bigger picture.
And part of what makes those surprises work is that they're putting it in Washington. They're putting it, they already know the viewer has specific expectations, and they can activate those expectations without. I mean, that's another thing that interests me is they're not showing a very realistic portrayal of what it's like to be a congressman. They're not showing, you know, some of the actual political plots themselves are not very interesting, and they don't really tie to a lot of things that you see go on. You pointed out in an earlier show that you can't really pick a character and say, well, that's based on this character, that's based on that character.
Yeah.
That's obviously
they're
deliberate.
Very archetypical.
A lot of the, I think one of the reasons why that trip back to his home district was so implausible and ridiculous was because they don't want any of the political intrigues to resemble anything that you've read in the newspaper.
No, yeah.
They don't want, you know, they want them to...
We're dealing in symbols here.
Yeah, they don't want them to be outrageously stupid, but they don't want them to be familiar either. They don't want you to get wrapped up in that part. They want you to pay attention to what the characters are doing, why they're doing it, and who they're interacting with. But they put it in the modern American political context just enough that you let your guard down.
Yes.
And you have certain expectations about what's going to happen.
Which is probably their trick and probably is a very useful tool then.
Yeah.
Is that you go in knowing what your viewer expects because you're dealing with such a cliched scenario.
Yep.
And so you can have a lot of fun playing to that, playing against that, back and forth. By the way, you're welcome. You would not have gone back and watched it if I
No, I wouldn't have.
You're welcome.
Well, I wouldn't say I think it's the greatest show ever, but it has been an interesting experience
watching it.
Right? No, I'd say it was worth it, sure. And mostly for the same reasons that I think it was worth watching for you, which was the conversation value of it.
Which I'm still not done, but yeah. The intricacy of it. I like shows that make me think not only about what the show is saying, but how the show was made.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. What was on... And there are so many shows that I'm like... Not only do I not know or care, the people who made it don't know or care.
Well,
which is most of the TV shows
these days. Here's part of why
Which I'm sad to say is what S.H.I.E.L.D. is. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is going to shit. Yeah. I'm still watching, but
Here's part of why Netflix might keep making... Even if their shows are not great by themselves, why they're still going to stack up next to anything else. This is probably the thing that they're doing that's going to make all of their shows, even the not-so-good ones, pretty good. And that is, they make the whole season at once.
Yes.
And they release the whole season at once. That's the big problem with every other show out there, is that they'll switch their direction midstream based on what viewers are doing. They'll put out, like with Almost Human, they'll put out the episodes out of order. But Netflix, you make the whole season. Before you even release it, the whole season's made, and then the can, and then you put it out there.
And
that makes a huge difference.
And a corollary to that, and I don't know the inner workings of Netflix, let alone their production company, but it appears, and I would imagine, the shows are less made by committee. Regular network television shows, so many people have to get in, and standards and practices have to get involved, and the network executives have to get involved, and marketing research has to get involved, in addition to writer, director, actors, and they all influence, so stuff gets cut, stuff gets added for flimsy, sometimes stupid, sometimes really pointless reasons. I'm guessing you cut down on that a lot when Netflix is making themselves and they're not dealing with a producer, they're not dealing with a network, they're not really even dealing with sponsors.
Possibly.
That's just a guess, though.
But, I mean...
Because I feel like Netflix didn't even actually make this show. I feel, and this may be just me misremembering, I feel like people made it and sold it to Netflix.
Well, maybe that's true.
It all still applies.
Yeah, but all shows should work this way.
Yeah,
every show, if it's going to get aired, it should get its full season in order all at once without any... Okay, we're going to go on hiatus and perhaps retool and take the show a completely different direction. No. Have one consistent, good story arc season. At least one.
Yeah.
Because I think that, I think a show should already have six seasons worth of arcs before it starts. But at least if it has one season, you can, when you go into the next season, it can make some sense. And take it one season at a time. And I think all the TV shows will
get
better.
And it helps if you have the direction that first season, because that's frequently when... A lot of people are finding their footing.
Yeah, right.
Although, if you have it nailed down, it's not an issue, like with this one.
Yeah.
There was no getting comfortable with the characters in this one. People were nailing it from
day one.
That's true.
That's really true.
You have a lot to say when you didn't do anything in the week.
Well, I decided to talk about that house card stuff.
Took him a week to decide it, people. I hope it was worth it for you.
Well, also, I felt like we had time because you've got to talk about this other thing, and I didn't feel like that would take 20 minutes
around. Oh, I got several things, though.
Okay.
Like I said.
Well, I didn't have to talk about this.
Yeah, you did. I feel it was important to you.
Whatever.
Also, I also talked a little bit in there. I don't know if you noticed. So my second week of the 2 weeks gone, we went to Michigan, driving through Illinois and then a little bit through Indiana up into southwest Michigan, which apparently, if you're from there or around there, is called Michiana.
Yeah, sometimes Michigan, called that.
Indiana.
Berrien Springs, Michigan is in that area, and I lived there for a summer.
Mm. This was St. Joseph's.
Yeah, St. Joseph's is right just north of there, yep.
On the lake, we stayed in a hotel. It was very nice. We had that experience that I think I talked about that I had in Wales before, of basically being the only tourists. It's a very tourist spot, but nobody's there this time of year. Cause it looks like hell. Lake Michigan was basically frozen over. So it was just locals, and we stood out, and people would approach us. We went to a... Well, I think I talked about it. They put on Follies. It was a fundraiser for a local music academy, and we were probably the only people that weren't from the area. And it was a large crowd, and a photographer was there taking pictures, and he took a picture of us, and then he's like writing down our names for it. He's like, "Where are you guys from?" And we said, "Iowa City, Iowa." And he stops. He's like, "What the hell are you doing here?" And we're like, "We're on vacation. We heard about this, thought it'd be fun." And then we saw him later the next night at a restaurant that we had gone back to a second time. He was there, so he came back and talked to us, and he was all telling everybody else. And
it's a charming town, though.
And we had some really good food.
Yeah. I think the locals call it St. Joe, I think. Don't they?
I think that
usually
comes
call
up
it that?
A fair bit.
St. Joe.
We ate twice at a place called Silver Beach Pizza, which had a truly, truly unique pizza that was really good. It's a very thin crust. The pans they cook it in have little nubs sticking up in it, which I think affect it. But the other thing is, the top, I don't know what the mixture of cheese is, but it's all done very thin, and it's cooked on the top so the cheese is all browned. And it makes for a very thin, fairly crispy pizza with very dark cheese on the top. And it was really good. The first time we went, we had the Greek garlic, which is one of the most popular, which is red pepper flakes and fresh garlic and pepperoni. And it was really good. And then we went back and had a different one that was a few kinds of meat and fresh garlic. And it was also really good. And they had really good local beers. And it was a nice place. Then we went to a couple other places, Mongolian Grill. We went to a place out in the middle of nowhere. You can see the bag over there. The Chocolate Garden. That is apparently famous for the truffles. Like, they've been on the Food Network a few times. Also, I was there. Little sort of incidental thing. But on Netflix, we figured out how to use the Chromecast, which was fun. So we could put Netflix up on our television there. We watched a thing on Netflix that is a concert video. It's Pink's The Truth About Love Tour. And I would recommend that to anybody who's even somewhat fond of her music. There's a lot of theatrics involved. There's lots of sort of interstitials and stuff. And it was good stuff, and it was good music. Most of the songs I recognized, some I didn't. One I didn't recognize, and I liked it well enough that I bought it. But just really great production values and some really cool sort of circus act things in there and some choreography interstitials. And there's sort of an MC for the whole thing that's not her, who's sort of a comedic entity that's pretty fun. So I would recommend that if you enjoy her music at all. That's mostly my group got together and played again. My role-playing group. Not SWAT. We played the main campaign, which, after some discussion, we have come up with a name for it. We are referring to it now as the Broken Ice campaign. I discussed that it was difficult not to have a name for it, because in the past we referred to Dresden Files as the Dresden Files game because that's what we were playing. Technically, I'm using Star Blazer Adventures system, but I'm not using the setting at all, and so it feels weird to call it that. And we can call it the main campaign, but that won't always be true. So, and I like having a title to a campaign. So, one of my players came up with Broken Ice, and I like it. So that's what we're playing. There's not a particularly interesting adventure. It mostly involved shopping. When I gave them the ship, I sort of took away all their other gear. So they kind of had to buy a lot of things. And it was mostly about that. And we didn't get a lot done, and this is a good problem to have. I sort of couldn't get them moving in the plot because they were all busy role-playing their characters with each other. Which was boring and annoying to me, but really good for them, and I'm glad they did it. They're very much getting into their characters very quickly. I like that. So that was cool, but yeah, it wasn't a particularly interesting session. Last night, for date night, there's two parts to date night, and both of them I feel worth commenting about.
Okay.
First is we went to eat. The producer, it was her date night, so she picked this stuff. She wanted a good burger. And we realized we didn't really know a place in Iowa City that had a good burger.
I thought that place near here was a good burger place.
That has burgers that are good to eat.
Okay.
They put a lot of good stuff on them, and so you can make a tasty sandwich. The burger itself, you can tell because of the shaping of it, actually, it has that scalloping thing, clearly frozen beforehand.
Oh.
And that's the thing. Shorts, famous for their burgers around here. We went one time, and I had a burger with a bunch of crazy crap on it, and it was good that time. But the burger itself, pretty dry, not that good. Oh. She wanted a place where the actual burger was good.
But, like, hamburgers are supposed to be really good.
I've never had a hamburger one. I don't know. But I couldn't think of a place. Every time I go to Hamburg Inn, I just get breakfast. And then I remembered there was a relatively new place downtown, Teddy's Bigger Burger, that we had never been. So we went there. It's sort of a fast foody place. It looks like a fast foody place. They have big signs explaining how they're not fast food because it takes longer for their stuff to cook. But they're apparently a very successful Hawaiian burger chain that is now here. In fact, there was a sign in there that said, America's number one party school meets Hawaii's number one burger. I couldn't believe they would put up a sign like that, and then I realized there was a particular demographic that don't find that embarrassing, and therefore it was probably fine for them. I am kind of horrified that my town has the number one party school. But
you are?
A little bit.
Well, I mean,
mostly because I feel like I partied as hard or harder than these kids and managed to not get famous for being an asshole.
University of Iowa and Iowa City is, they've had that distinction more than once.
Yes.
I mean, back when I was in college, it was like that.
And
I found annoying, actually.
Not because they are the hardest partying school, which is a dubious distinction anyway, but because they are sloppy about it.
Maybe.
They get found out. They get put in the paper a lot for high percentages of binge drinking incidents and all sorts of fun date rape. I really don't think this is something that we want to.
Well, I was never proud of it, obviously. I remember.
No, but I just want to make the point that I'm coming from a perspective of a guy who loved to party in college and who did some really stupid and, in some cases, illegal things. And even I think this is dumb. Because you do it right. You don't do it right. Town can't hold its liquor. Or the college can, at least. It pisses me off. Anyway, the burger place is very good. I had an enormous burger, a 9-ounce burger. Very tasty. Had a bunch of crap on it. I think one of the main secrets to why their burgers are so good, and I think more places need to learn from this, their burgers, by default, unless you say otherwise, are cooked medium. So they're still pink inside. But it makes nice, tender, juicy burger, and it's really tasty. I will very likely be going back. But they also have fries and all sorts of crap you can put on the fries. We had garlic butter fries, which were really tasty, but there's lots of things you can put on the fries. You can actually do a salad, like, here's the greens, and then there's a list of different things you could put on the salad, stuff like that. They do shakes. The shake wasn't that exciting. They'll do chicken breast. They have a veggie burger they will do. They have a turkey burger they will do. A lot of different variants. But I liked it. And so if there's one near you, if you're in Hawaii or whatever, Teddy's Bigger Burger. Check it out. It's quite tasty. The other thing is we watched a movie last night on demand. It just recently was done in the theaters. It's now on demand. It's a movie called About Time.
Okay.
Have you heard of it?
No.
All right. That complicates things. Some of you may have heard of it. There's a train a couple blocks away, so that may be the noise you're hearing. Here's what I'm going to tell you about it. I'm going to base it on what I saw about it, based on the trailers for it. It is a story about a young British kid, young man, who on his 21st birthday is informed by his father, played by Bill Nighy, that all the men in their family have, as far back as anybody can remember, the ability to travel back in time throughout their own life and change things if they so choose. And, of course, kid doesn't believe him, and turns out it's true, hijinks ensue. And, by and large, this then manifests in his whirlwind time-traveling romance with the woman who, the love of his life. It comes off very much looking, it's a romantic comedy, British time travel thing. The love of his life is Rachel McAdams, who I am not a fan of. So I was not super interested in this movie. I probably would not have seen this movie. The producer was into it. She is a little more of a sucker for certain types of sort of romantic comedies. And Bill Nighy is in it, which is always a good sign. And it was just sweet, and it had some funny lines in the trailer. And so she wanted to see it, and, you know, why not? Cost us $5 or whatever to watch it on demand. So we watched it. I really loved this movie. Like, a lot. Like, more than I have a movie in a long time. Apparently has gotten quite mixed reviews. I really loved it. I should say, very important aspect here, it is not a romantic comedy. It even gets billed that some ways. It is not. It is much more a sort of looking at the life of the main character.
Mm-hmm.
It's him from a certain age and goes through a long period of time. During that, there's a fair bit that involves his romance with this woman,
mm-hmm.
but that's not what the movie is about by any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. It is... Remember we talked about that damn movie with Justin Timberlake where they had the time of how long they live on the arms?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a pretty dumb movie, but it was enjoyable because it was genuine speculative fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And the mechanism didn't necessarily make sense, but that wasn't the point. They set up the arbitrary... They posit the arbitrary mechanism to do what if. That's absolutely what is happening here. The time travel, it's a little clunky. In places it even contradicts if you look too closely. It's used as a speculative device to look at how we live our lives and what we might do if we could do this sort of thing and what that might mean.
Mm-hmm.
There's no butterfly effect bullshit. It's it's genuinely, if you could change stuff, would you? If you did, what do you think would happen? Mm-hmm. What does all this mean? And it was wonderful. It was quite clever. Everyone does really good job acting. It felt, time travel aside, the interactions, the dialogue felt very real to me.
Mm.
Very believable. I very much got caught up in the emotion of it. It made me cry a couple times. And I don't know that it's going to be for everyone. I don't know who I would recommend. I know I can recommend it unreservedly to my parents. They will love it. I don't know who else. Like, I don't know if I to tell you to see it or not. But I really loved it a lot.
Well, maybe we'll see it.
I really enjoyed it. And it was quite thought-provoking. Like, it was time to go to bed afterwards, and I got to bed a little late because the producer and I were talking about parts of it and things that were hinted at that I didn't feel like we weren't sure. There's a couple of things that I'm like, I think this was sort of implying this happened. Because there's a variety of characters and there's sort of dimensions to a lot of them. And just as P.S., Rachel McAdams was wonderful. She did a great job. I do not like her in most things. She was wonderful in this. She did an incredible job. She was a great choice. But all the casting was very good. Yeah, so we saw that. About Time. It was a good film. I liked it a lot. I loved it. Yeah, I think that's all I got.
Okay.
So, good night.
Did you know that Batman is 75 years old this year?
Did you know that Bob Kane didn't really invent Batman?
Not completely, anyway.
Well, not mostly. He invented the idea of a man that was bat-like.
Well, Bill Finger probably is mostly responsible for the story and everything.
Bill Finger. And for most of the Rogues.
But when this airs, my understanding is that the first issue, Detective Comics number 27, that he was in, hit newsstands on the 30th. So that's going to be a few days back for people listening.
But for us, it'll be 3 days in the future.
But it was a May issue. It's the May issue of DC Comics. But it was on newsstands.
The May issue hit March 30th?
Well, it was, the May issue was in stores during April. Or I mean,
but before April.
April, yeah. April, all through April, the May issue was being sold, is what I'm saying.
But even 2 days of March.
I guess so, yeah.
Bastards. They were on a different calendar then. They were still on the Julian calendar back then.
So, yeah, 75 years ago this month, people were buying the Detective Comics number 27, and that was the first with a Batman story in it. I don't think that had the origin story yet. I think that came later, but that was Bill Finger's work, yeah.
Something today also reminded me that the weird-ass, super racist reaction to 9/11 that Frank Miller did, called, I think, The Holy Terror or something, was originally supposed to be a Batman story.
Oh.
And then DC was like, no, we can't do that.
You know, you've heard that there's going to be a Gotham TV series.
I have. I'm waiting to see what happens with that. Did you know there also was, long, long ago now, I think shortly after the original Tim Burton Batman, going to be an animated high school cartoon about Gotham that basically took all the characters and made them high school students?
No, I didn't know that.
Yes.
I'm glad that didn't happen.
I've seen well, artwork from it and things.
But did you know that Smallville was not what they were going to produce at first? They were going to produce a show called Bruce Wayne, and it was going to be about him when he was a teenager, and then...
I thought they're still doing that now.
No. But they couldn't get... The licensing thing was all messed up for the Batman property, so then they moved over to Clark, and did Smallville. Oh, right. Now... This Gotham show is not going to be about Bruce primarily. It's going to be about Jim Gordon before he's the commissioner.
But I thought they were doing somebody was doing something with a young Bruce Wayne.
No, he's going to be in it. The kid that was in Touch or whatever is going to be Bruce. And I think in the pilot, Jim is going to meet Bruce, cause this right after his parents are killed. That's like the first murder that Jim Gordon investigates. This isn't... what happens, I don't think any comic book story says that. The first time they ever have Gordon have anything to do with a young Bruce Wayne after his parents are killed is in the movie, is in Batman Begins. Before that, Gordon always comes to Gotham City much later as a lieutenant or something, and he goes up in the ranks.
Yeah.
But he didn't know Bruce Wayne as a kid. I like that. I thought when Nolan did that was actually pretty cool.
No, I think it's
and
a
I
thing.
Really like the idea of it being like the first thing he investigated when he got to Gotham. I think that's great.
I like it because Gordon doesn't know who it is.
Yeah.
It'd be less cool otherwise. He just becomes goddamn Whistler from Blade. Otherwise.
Well, to me, it's a progression of the character, because for a long time, Gordon was just the commissioner of Gotham. Didn't mean anything.
Yeah.
And they've slowly made him a really important character and a friend to Bruce Wayne and Batman. So I think this is actually a good progression to have him in Gotham City when Bruce's parents are killed and have him meet Bruce when he's a boy. I think that's a really cool thing. I think the show might be good. I hope it's good.
I recently saw, only once so far, a commercial that Gary Oldman is in, which is very surprising that he's doing a commercial.
Like a new commercial? Not like, yes, a commercial
no,
back
one
in the day
now
or something?
It's for a cell phone. I believe it's the HTC One. And what happens is you see him in an apartment someplace. And he says, blah, 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 and does this for 10, 15 seconds. And sits down and says, blah. It doesn't matter what I say, because the HTC One is designed for people who make up their own minds. So go on the internet and see what people say. And then they get the logo on everything, and then he looks off and he goes, blah, blah, blah. And it's so weird, because obviously there's supposed to be this calculated disinterest, and that's the whole point, like, that's the point of the commercial. But it's Gary Oldman, and Gary Oldman doing sort of quirky, calculated disinterest. It really looks like somebody basically fooled him into doing this commercial, and he doesn't give a damn. So it was very weird, because he really, and I mean, I think that's to his credit. I think he's very carefully performing it that way. I don't think he just happens to not give a damn. Because it feels like that. But yeah, it has that vibe of, whatever. You go look at the phone. I'm Gary fucking Oldman. Seriously? Yeah, I was just really shocked to see him. I thought I had a different thing. I don't remember. Oh my god. I don't think I have it anymore. There's a weird set of sketches somebody did that's all about Star Wars, but it's set as a high school thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird.
Well, like high school in the 80s even or something.
Yes. And it was very... The producer showed it to me, and it was very interesting, but also I was like, what in the universe asked for this to be made?
Well, you can say that about a lot of things that you find
online.
I know, but this
one seems so intensely random and executed really well. It's not just like some stoner was like, dude, what if they were in high school in the 80s? Like, somebody really, like, it's kind of an elaborate art set and well done and amusing. But I was just like, I guess, how creative? Mostly I'm just like, that feels like... That feels like it doesn't fit in the world.
It's a thing, though. I mean, you know, you see this periodically, like,
it's
on
basically
Facebook.
A version of Muppet Babies. Is
no,
what
well, no, it's like you see this on Facebook or Google Plus or whatever it is you get in a feed with these picture things. One really popular thing is to take the Disney princesses and do something with them.
Oh, yes,
put them in
true.
A particular
that
situation. Or take DC superheroes and make them put them in the Old West,
yes,
or whatever.
Or
so this is really the same
chibi
kind of thing.
Versions of things.
This is really the same kind of thing, and actually, it's not really that random, because all you're doing is you're taking. I mean, when you look at the Star Wars original Star Wars characters, and the hair and everything,
yeah,
the way they interact, it's like, wow, it's like they're in high school. Hey, what if they were in high school in the 70s or 80s?
It shows a fascinating message.
Yeah. It's pretty obvious. It's one of the more obvious ones, I thought.
I do love, like, the last shot was Luke and Han and Chewie doing the muscle dance thing from Breakfast Club that the three guys are doing. Yeah, I saw that the other day.
Well, then you have mashups. I mean, those are the...
Yeah.
Sometimes the mashups are, you don't know how anyone thought of that, and it might not resonate with you at all, but then you'll see the comments, like a whole bunch of people thinking it's great, and you're scratching your head. But it's all about what resonates with people. I mean,
people are stupid.
No, they're different. A lot of people have different ways of seeing things.
People are different. Also,
no, people aren't stupid.
A lot of them are.
No, I don't think so. I think when people do things that seem stupid, it's either not stupid at all, and it just doesn't resonate with you, or they've got some serious problems and issues that it's not being stupid. They're just
four people
just,
are stupid.
They just have problems.
out of 7 billion.
A lot of people have problems.
You got to give me that. Out of 7 billion, 4 billion are stupid.
Okay.
4 billion stupid people.
You know, we live in a culture that wants people to be mentally unstable.
I know, and because, they're doing it really well.
Yeah, they are. But that's not stupidity. That's mental illness. That's like everybody in the United States is on a spectrum of mental illness. Everybody.
You can be mentally ill and stupid.
Well, and I guess I don't know what stupid means. Because there's
stupid is
because
as stupid does.
Ignorant is a person just doesn't know. And that doesn't seem fair to call them stupid.
I said 4 billion, which is way more than just the U.S.
Okay. All right, whatever.
There's a lot of
others. We should really start drawing things out of the hat, I think.
Really?
Yeah, I think so.
All right.
I mean, I think that's what we're here for.
This is for you other 3 billion out there. Although I don't know why you 3 billion. Seriously.
Shut up.
All you have to do is draw
just
a out of a hat.
Shut up.
I'm uncoordinated.
Shut up.
To a frightening degree.
I am. This is from Anonymous.
Oh, Anonymous. Our most valued listener. I know.
What do you make out of culture's current obsession with zombies? Well, I can make a hat or a pterodactyl.
I made a proscenium arch. I stapled the zombies together and then hot glued the entire thing.
I think there's a lot to be said about it. I mean, you can have a really deep analysis. You can have a really superficial and obvious analysis.
Yeah, I mean, people say it's communism. They used to say a lot. I think it's the new Nazis. Zombies are awesome because you have no moral ambiguity. You can kill the shit out of all the zombies, and all you're doing is a good thing. Same thing with Nazis. You kill Nazis, no, but you're always the good guy if you're killing Nazis. Anybody else, it's like, oh, we got to see their side. But it's Nazis, so fuck them. Zombies, same thing. Like, oh, see it from the zombie side. There is no zombie side. Essentially, at this point, they are killing machines.
Oh, see it from the zombie side. Well, I'll say this. What you're saying can work for almost any monster, except for what you just said, the see it from the zombie side part. And I think it does say something about our world right now where we do want the monster we're fighting. Because any monster you can say that about, except that just about every other kind of monster, they've had some sympathetic treatment of it.
Yes, exactly.
Vampires, werewolves. I mean, you can portray the demons even. You can portray these monsters in a negative way where the audience members don't feel any remorse about them getting blown away. But they're so often treated in a sympathetic way. There's no, I mean, people are trying now to make zombie romances.
Shaun of the Dead did that. Warm Bodies is a huge example of that.
But I don't think those are going to catch on because zombie people...
Well, I hope they will because then the zombie craze can end, goddammit.
Well, but I think the way zombies have been defined, the only other monster I can think of where it's going to be really difficult to portray them sympathetically as a demon. That has been done, actually.
Yes, because then you just take sort of the fallen angel type.
Yeah.
It's really easy.
But the way most people understand zombies, to have a zombie have feelings and emotions and thoughts and feel like it's being discriminated against or whatever, goes so against what people normally think of a zombie to be that I don't think that's going to take. I think that...
It's essentially a rabid animal. It doesn't think or feel.
Yeah.
It's going to kill you. And even if you left it alone, it's not going to...
Right.
It's going to die.
Right. So I think there is that piece of it where it's a monster that you're not going to have a very effective portrayal of it in a sympathetic light. So you're always going to feel okay killing it. But it's not just that. It's that there's a lot of them. It's that you can become one if you're bit. All that stuff comes into it and is important.
I don't know. Maybe this is the thing. Because I'm fucking sick of zombies. I hate zombies.
Well, I've never been a fan of zombies, really.
But you might hit the nail on the head, though. It's a sympathy thing again. Even my monsters, I need some sympathy. I just don't give a damn about zombies. Zombies are boring. When you do zombies as nature, which is coming up more, essentially, Walking Dead, you could argue, is that. The world is gonna kill you. You know, zombies are the biggest, you know, obstacle course out there.
Well, they're essentially human-sized viruses. That's all.
Well, and as the producer likes to point out, because she still watches Walking Dead, the way they've done it, everybody has the virus, so you are guaranteed when you die
to become
a zombie. And that's a major factor, and I do think that's interesting. But ultimately, then it just becomes a survival story. It's man versus nature. Nature, in this case, is some fucked up zombie
shit.
Yeah,
I think that's right.
I still don't particularly care. I'm not a big man versus the environment person. I don't care. Survival skills and survival in difficult situations, whatever, has never interested me. I'm way more interested in when we've got survival covered and we start dealing with the weird other echelons of civilization that appear after that. Politics, religion, friendship, weird social custom, you know, that kind of shit. I'm way more interested.
No, I am too. But, you know, a lot of people, you know, like I say, it's sort of, it's a version of an apocalypse where the threat never goes away.
Yeah.
It's not like, okay, a bomb drops and after the first few months when people are dying of cancer or whatever, then it's over. Then it's all about
rebuilding. Zombie apocalypse,
the part that interests us is that rebuilding part. Yes. And all the interesting things. But in a zombie apocalypse situation, you don't have time to rebuild. There's not a way to rebuild. You don't know even if the whole race is eventually just going to become extinct. Yeah. And it's going to be a long time before it, drawn out time before it becomes extinct.
Yeah.
So it creates a very particular kind of post-apocalyptic story. And also, I do think for most people it's a metaphor for, you know, human, for a collapse of our culture that comes from, you know, hubris of one kind or another.
Yeah.
And like you said, in this way, nature sort of gets back at us by turning us all into zombies, and we devour each other.
Yes, and it was a metaphor for communism. It was a metaphor for television. It's a metaphor for the internet. I mean, there's a lot of people. Anything that they feel,
for consumerism.
Yeah. Any
literal consumerism
basically turns people into sheep.
Yeah. Right.
Can be done that way, and yeah, that's the part that doesn't. I don't know. I'm way more into post-apocalyptic story, Defiance, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Where the whole point is shit has happened,
mm-hmm.
and now we're trying to build something.
With the aliens that came and caused some of them. That's a very interesting angle.
That is a good one. But just in general, you have this, because frequently post-apocalyptic, something has changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now we're dealing with the fact that everything's radioactive. Now we're dealing with the fact that alien technology is sitting around. Now we're dealing with the fact that there are mutants that we have to watch out for sometimes. Or, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
With zombies, it's just constant. And that's the one apocalypse. I mean, all the apocalypses don't do well for. I'm not good apocalypse material. But the zombie one especially, I'm killing myself just right off the bat. Like, I don't want to survive in that situation.
Yeah.
Other shit where maybe we rebuild, it could get interesting later, great. Spending the rest of my life running from fucking zombies, not interested. Just kill me now.
No, it's not something that fascinates me either. But, I mean, you know, in my household, the other adult in the house is interested in anything that has to do with, you know, biological effect, warfare, or epidemics, or anything like that.
Hate all of this.
And you know, the whole zombie thing in that context is very interesting to her. But also, she actually is in the whole surviving in an apocalypse thing. So even though, again, that's not really about, the zombie things aren't really about surviving the apocalypse after it happens. It's the apocalypse is always happening. There's still a piece of that that's in there that interests her. So overall, the whole zombie thing.
There's a whole section of society at this point that are zombie apocalypse preparers.
Well,
Well, no, no, no. Here's the thing, though. Specifically, they are zombie apocalypse preparers, but they're not idiots who think that zombies are going to happen. They like the genre, and they like, because there's a big social interactivity of doing this. And the reasoning behind it is if you actually prep as though zombies were going to happen,
you'll be prepared for other apocalypses, real things.
Totally might happen.
That's right.
And so it sort of combines your hobby and interest with actual survival skills.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which I see, again, don't care. I wouldn't do well in any apocalypse. I really wouldn't. But I would at least give it a shot if it wasn't zombies or you know, any other giant spiders or whatever. I don't know.
I think the original, where the term zombie comes from, the original zombie, which was someone who was dead but controlled by
the Haitian
some
version,
yeah. Witch doctor or whatever. That to me is so much more interesting and a storytelling element than what we call zombies today.
It is potentially because there's a power dynamic again, which makes it interesting.
Well, and also
a regular zombie then just becomes part of the background.
And also if even if you tell the story where the person is dead and being controlled by a witch doctor, to me it's more interesting. But then if you consider that the quote-unquote real zombies never were really dead, but they were given a drug and then there's a lot of suggestion, that becomes even more interesting.
Yes.
But when the zombies, the things we call zombies now are just undead, really. They're just dumb undead. And, I mean, you know, vampires were the same thing. They got up from their graves and they hunted people and they fed off of them and they went back to their graves. It, really the same thing. Zombies, we call zombies are the same thing except dumber. And yeah, not interesting to me. I mean, the metaphors are kind of cool at first, but then I'm done and it's not interesting to watch.
Neil Gaiman has a short story called Bitter Grounds that is in New Orleans and dealing with the zombie thing. And it's very interesting and has that aspect of a particular individual is talked about who basically is a zombie now, but sort of doesn't believe he's a zombie. Because what it basically comes down to is he is basically completely addicted to the zombie powder. And so basically they get him to do things for the powder, and sometimes they're things they want done, sometimes they're things just to exert power over him to prove they can,
that's interesting.
There's more to the story than even that, but that's sort of a story within a story in it that I thought was very interesting.
Well, and right, in the original zombies are, you might not be able to tell they're a zombie. I mean, they act perfectly normal, but what makes them a zombie is they are being controlled by somebody else. More than the fact that they're dead is that they're being controlled by somebody else. And you, if you didn't happen to know they quote-unquote died, then they might just seem like a normal person to you, but someone else is controlling them and you don't even know. Which, again, that, to me, that's interesting and fascinating, but what people call zombies today, you know, zombie walks, people do that, and that doesn't interest me. I don't even know what the appeal of that is.
That kind of seems amusing to me. I might try it someday, but, yeah. Well, and it becomes, I also am not interested, and you know me, I tend to like a lot of horror genres and stuff. I'm not interested in ones that are about, like, a rabid bear in the woods.
Right.
I'm like, yeah, okay, shit can kill you. That sucks. It's not a story to me. I mean, natural disaster ones, too. I'm like, I don't care.
I think it does say something. I mean, I think whatever is really popular in a culture does say something about that culture, what they're thinking about, what they're afraid of, and so on. And I do think that the consumerism in American culture is actually a very scary thing. It is something that could really harm our culture down the road. I think it's something that...
Not if we can afford it.
I think it does convert people into sort of mindless... And I think it's also contagious. I mean, all the things that, you know, zombies are, I think consumerism really is that, and it is scary, but I don't...
That reminds me, we still got to pick up Diablo 3.
I don't think zombies are enlightening people to these things. I think the craze about zombies is just another incidence of consumerist culture taking over and...
Stop consuming zombies, people.
It's ironic, isn't it?
You don't know where they've been.
It's ironic that that zombies aren't consuming us, we're consuming them.
It's Ouroboros. Here's an interesting thing.
Okay.
Do you remember the movie The NeverEnding Story?
Mm-hmm. I don't think I saw the whole thing, though. I've seen only parts of it.
I'm not surprised. You're what, 42?
I just turned 45.
You're old.
Yeah.
All right. I was shocked that there was a coworker of mine who is a big fantasy geek. She sort of always has been into that stuff. Come to find out, she never saw NeverEnding Story. I'm like, what the hell is wrong with you?
Well, you probably didn't want to start and then never...
Ah!
You know, just get stuck watching it forever.
I loved it when I first saw it. I loved it so much. I saw the second one, which was terrible. I eventually saw the third one, which made the second one look good. And I believe it was a direct-to-DVD release, but or video back in those days. Anyway, I was talking about this fact to the producer that she hadn't seen it. I couldn't believe it, and it was terrible. And the producer allowed us how she hadn't seen it. She'd eventually seen it, but it had taken a while, and she doesn't particularly remember it or have a big interest in it. And we figured out sort of what it is. There is a very specific age thing associated with it, because the film is essentially... I mean, there is a coming-of-age aspect to it, but it's largely about embracing your inner childlike creativity and imagination even as you get older. And to me, who at the time would have been about the age of the main character, that's awesome. The belief that I, with my imagination, have the power to make dragons and stuff like that is a really cool idea. To somebody who's, say, 5, 8, 10 years older than me, who's basically in high school probably at the time, the idea of continuing to embrace your childhood rather than go forward into stoic adulthood probably sounds terrible. And the stupid baby stuff. It's the exact opposite message of how you're focusing your life when you're that age. Mm. And my coworker, as it happens, is a few years older than me. So I think that's what it is. Also found out she hasn't seen The Dark Crystal, and now I'm just mad.
Well, I've seen that a couple of times.
Have you heard of Steven Spielberg and George Lucas? They're both pretty big guys. And they got together, and not Steven Spielberg.
Jim Henson.
Jim Henson and George Lucas got together and made something pretty impressive.
It is really impressive, actually.
It's not a good story. It's a really impressive visual thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Supposedly, the original cut of it had less narrative. Supposedly, the original cut was meant to be a very surreal alien world that was sort of difficult to understand. That was Henson's original sort of picture of it. But yeah, it's an amazing movie. Amazing soundtrack, amazing visuals, amazing effects. No goddamn CGI.
That was really good.
Yeah. And also seminal.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I use that word way too much lately, but it's true. I feel that's part of why I finally watched Fargo. I was like, I can't be a part of the discussion of modern film and not have seen it. That's why they're even filmmakers I don't like, there's films I'm like, you should see it so that you can talk, so that you have the context. Honestly, I feel that way about certain of Tarantino's films. I believe Tarantino has, we talked about this last week, or for us, like an hour ago, Tarantino has talent. I feel like, maybe not that he doesn't have anything to say anymore, I no longer care about what he has to say. And I think that's a subject of the time period. I don't think that's just a subject of my age. I feel like in the 90s, what he had to say had
relevance.
Yes, and yeah. I feel like it does not now. I feel like what the Coen brothers have to say still does have relevance. But yeah, I just don't care anymore for Tarantino. And I feel like he's... he went from being purposely transgressive to sort of incidentally transgressive. I've never seen Inglourious Basterds. I don't think I ever will bother. Also didn't see Django Unchained. Like, they both, just at their heart to me, seem so personally offensive. Like, again, I don't fault anybody else for it, but just conceptually, I'm like, I don't want to see a movie about those things.
Yeah, I think I know what you mean.
I'm not interested. That's a problem I have, the producer and I are both having right now with Captain Phillips.
Oh, yeah.
Supposedly, it's goddamn amazing. On paper, I have no interest in that movie. There is no aspect of that movie that I'm at all curious about. But people just say the performances, it's just amazing. So at some point, I'll probably watch it.
See, my problem with a film like that, and there are lots of them like this, is, you know, they're based on something that really happened.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I don't forget that while I'm watching it. So, you know, I can be really affected by that, and I can start to feel a little bad.
Yeah.
About sitting here in a context where I'm supposed to be entertained by these terrible things that happened to these people. You know what I mean?
That's...
If I want to know what happened to him and what stuff, I can. There's probably news sources I can look at, but to watch it dramatized
and sensationalized
and probably changed for dramatic effect and stuff, it starts to feel a little bit offensive, and so I can't.
I'll
really
do you one better. This drives me.
Which
crazy.
Again, I don't fault anyone else for watching it and liking it. That's just how I feel about it.
Horror movies about real life serial killers.
Oh man, do they make those?
They make a ton of them. Drives me crazy. Patrick Bacow, an actor I really like, was in this movie called The Gray Man, I think, and it was shown on a show, and I was like, oh, this looks really interesting. And I look it up. It's based off of an actual killer who also did stuff to children and just horrible shit.
No.
And I'm like, why would you make a non-documentary movie about... I mean, you could make the argument, why would you make a documentary? Why would you make a fictitious movie about that? That's terrible. There's movies about Ted Bundy. There's a ton of movies about Richard Speck, including some really low-budget, stupid ones.
I don't even know who that is.
Jeffrey
Dahmer, lots.
Yeah, Gacy's got one. Mm. And there's some stupid one that's I forgive, because it's like Jeffrey Dahmer versus Gacy, and it's a weird, shitty horror comedy where, like, gene splicing happens. And like, I'm like, whatever, then we're just bullshitting. But there are ones that are supposed to be the real... I'm like, why would you do that? The only thing that can really fuck me up for a horror movie is to be like, oh, this really happened? Well, now I'm traumatized.
Well, I mean, I sometimes feel this way about, you know, programs that are about war, like wars that happen, Civil War. I felt like...
I was not interested in any of the post 9/11 movies either.
Oh no, absolutely not. Now Michael, did Michael Bay do Pearl Harbor?
Was that? Yeah, I think so.
I found that film incredibly offensive because,
from what I heard, it was just bad.
This is something that happened to a lot of people, and people still know people that this happened to, and they're turning it into a movie with a romance and stuff. And I thought, this isn't right.
Yeah.
This isn't right to take this thing that really happened and people really died and was a real tragedy. And you're turning this into a...
They make a lot of video games about World War II.
Well, that's true. So it's, you know, it's...
People's grandfathers died and now I have to kill them again.
I find that very strange and weird.
Ezzy also feels strongly
about
this.
But, you know, like I say, I don't judge anybody else what they like, but that's how I feel about
it. I'm also weirded out about all the Vietnam movies. I haven't watched a lot of those. I've never... But again, I feel like I should. Like Platoon, Apocalypse Now. Apocalypse Now I'm less worried about because I've read Heart of Darkness. So I'm like, I get that we use Vietnam as the backdrop for a pre-existing story.
Yeah.
It's not about the Vietnam War. Platoon I'm really nervous about, and a couple others, but I'm like, I should watch them again.
Well,
some
of those, it kind of depends on what they're saying. Like, the thing that offended me about Pearl Harbor was that there was this love triangle or whatever in the middle of it, and like, that was the story, and Pearl Harbor was just, like, where it was happening, and I just thought, that's just awful. Now, but if they're telling a story of fictional people who experienced it, but they're trying to show you what it might have been like, and they're not really holding anything back in terms of the realism and stuff, then it becomes a little bit different thing, you know, like Platoon or something. They're not trying to entertain you. They're trying.
It's not exploitative. It's
But, you know, it's a gray area, I guess.
Matt Stone and Trey Parker, makers of South Park, made a movie called Team America World Police.
Mm-hmm.
It was a puppet movie.
Yeah.
In that movie, there is a love ballad sung by the male lead, which is primarily about how terrible the movie Pearl Harbor is. I believe the refrain in it is something about what I'm trying to say is Pearl Harbor sucked and I love you. Something along those lines. Anyway, we're way over time.
Mm.
And we've done it for 2 hours. So basically, it's 3 a.m.
No.
At Peter's Donuts. I didn't pick it on purpose. It just is there. It's 3 a.m. Here we are at Peter's Donuts. You gonna get your favorite donut, eh? Donut place. The guy's got 10 tables and 3 spots. Which is literally a joke I only got during the run of this podcast. I spent years listening to that. I didn't get what he was saying there. Anyway, that's it from us this week. I'm not good at closing. I'm not a closer. That's why I don't get to drink coffee. That's another one I need to see is Glengarry Glen Ross. Because again, I feel... And goddamn Wall Street. I haven't seen Wall Street.
Mm.
The hell's wrong with me? Not Wolf of, I mean the original.
No, yeah, I know.
Gordon Gekko, that shit. which is not a real name. Nobody's last name is Gekko. That's not a thing.
I'm sure someone's is.
No one in the world.
I mean, your last name is Parsons, so...
Yes.
Yeah. What?
I know you think you drew a connection there, but what that is just stating an unrelated fact. You can say it like that. It doesn't mean...
I thought that was pretty good.
Made.
No, I thought that was good.
You stand by that?
Yeah.
Well, all right. I'll be totally honest. I don't really have a comeback guess we'll have to agree to disagree, but not on what my last name is, because we've got that down.
Yeah.
I am totally with you on that.
Okay.
We are seeing eye to eye on what my last name is. If you'd like to comment on what you think my last name is, go to the blog, themagicaltalkinghat.com. Also, write the hat. I love all you people that write the hat. I really want you people that don't write the hat to write the hat.
That would be nice.
Shit that you are curious about and too lazy to look up on the internet. Email it to us. We won't look it up either. Well, we might, but we probably won't. But we'll come up with an interesting answer. So, I mean, just whatever you want to do, like, we'll do it.
Yeah.
We are monkeys here for your amusement. until next week, let's go fling some poo. Well, you're listening.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.